You are listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
In this special edition of the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar, Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb and me, Lionel Burney, sat down with the president of the UCI, Brian Cookson, on the eve of the 2014 Tour de France to ask him about the state of professional cycling at the moment.
Brian, unusual to see the UCI president at the Tour de France.
It's 12 months since I was here in last time in Corsica, this time last year, and I was on the election wagon, as it were, and now to be here as president is, and with this grand départ in the UK, is a great honour for me, and I'm very, very proud and pleased to be here.
But there is a serious point there, because relations between the UCI and the ASO have been strained under the previous regime. Have you been working quite hard to rebuild those, and do you feel that you're in a good place now?
Yeah, absolutely, Richard. And I've always had good relations with ASO in my time as British Cycling President, and we've been able to build on that. We put a lot of time and effort into getting away from any conflict. I don't see any advantage in being at war with ASO. They are a very successful organisation. They've done a great job with their events, and our job at UCI is to work with them and help them, not to get into conflict with them. So, that's basically what we're doing.
Do you get the sense they're equally keen to work positively with the UCI?
Yeah, I do. I don't think they want to be a governing body, and we don't want to be ASO either. And I think we all have our roles in the sport. And I think what's important is that we all work together harmoniously to try and develop our sport and to put it in a good position for the future.
Brian, this weekend we'll have a very healthy image of, we'll see a very healthy face of professional cycling here in Yorkshire. We've obviously had a big boom in cycling in this country. The other side of the coin, to a certain extent, is ongoing difficulties for teams finding sponsors. We've had news about Belkin in the last few weeks, Giant Shimano looking for sponsors. How concerned are you by that sort of, well, it's almost cyclisme à deux vitesses, in a financial sense, two-speed cycling?
These are issues that are right at the forefront of our thinking at the moment at UCI. We've been doing a lot of work behind the scenes to work on the reform of professional cycling. I think what we need to do is find new ways of making sport more sustainable financially. Just 2 days ago, I was in Germany speaking with some very senior people in German television about trying to support efforts to bring cycling back onto German television. Germany, as we all know, is the biggest economy in Western Europe, and we lost three big pro teams there in the terrible era back in 5-10 years ago, and all of the work that we're doing to restore the reputational damage that's been done to cycling in recent years is beginning to turn things around. But there'll be pluses and minuses, there'll be gains and losses as that process continues. But we're seeing a lot of interest now in cycling generally as a sport and pastime. I think we all of us in this room talking this evening, this morning, we'll have seen more and more people riding bikes than we've ever seen before. And certainly, I'm 63 now, and I've been a bike rider all my life, and I've never seen as many people out on bikes. So what we've got to do is transform that enthusiasm that there is for the sport and pastime at the grassroots level into commercial and economic success at the professional level. There's a way to go yet. We've got to look at new ways of exploiting the new technology, presenting cycling on television much more effectively. I think we've fallen behind the times, but we're looking and we're working and we're opening new possibilities there. We're trying out the cameras on bikes, and that seems to be a very, very successful experiment. As the technology develops, we hope to be able to do more of that. And my role at UCI is to push that forward, not to try and inhibit it, but to make it an advantage so that we do strengthen the economy of our sport.
Daniel mentions a very upbeat, very positive atmosphere. Already it's 7:30 in the morning, thousands of people flooding into the centre of Leeds to watch the Grand Depart, the whole of Yorkshire ready to celebrate professional cycling, and yet the kind of dark underbelly hasn't been entirely excised yet. because in recent weeks we've had three quite high profile doping cases: Diego Ulisi, Roman Kreuziger, who would have been here as a support rider for Alberto Contador, and Daryl Impey, who wore the yellow jersey just a year ago. So in terms of where cycling is with doping and where the UCI is with its anti-doping efforts, how do you assess the landscape at the moment?
Okay. Well, first of all, I can't comment on any particular specific ongoing case, and that's not right, and I won't do that. But I think what we have seen in recent weeks, first of all, is an indication that, look, we will never sweep anything under the carpet. If we have a problem, we will deal with it, and we will deal with it in the appropriate way, with integrity and transparency as much as we can within due process. It's always disappointing when you catch people who may be cheating. I think if we look at all sports, all walks of life, there will always be a certain number of people who try to cheat. When you have serious problems, I think, is when that becomes institutionalised, as in a way it was in the Armstrong era, if I can call it that. I think that we've broken the back of that particular institutionalised level of doping. I don't think there's any of that going on. I hope not. Can never be 100% sure. But what we've done, and it was a process that's been ongoing for a number of years, and I give credit to my predecessor for the work that he did on the biological passport and so on. What we've been doing is gradually lowering the radar, so it's very, very difficult to get under it now. And, you know, these are very complex cases now. If you look at the long-term implications of biological passport cases, you know, they're not just about is there a substance or is there not? It's about manipulation of values and levels of sometimes naturally occurring substances. So that's why these cases can take a long period of time. But as I say, what I think we're doing as part of all of that is lowering the radar. It's very difficult to get below that now. Doesn't mean that we've stopped people cheating. There will still always be a percentage of people who try. And I think what we're seeing now is that, look, there's a lesson here, I think, from the Lance Armstrong era, which is that if you're cheating, we will catch you sooner or later. It might take a few months. It might even take a few years. But sooner or later, especially where there are multiple people involved in conspiracies, those things start to fall apart. And if you've built your success, your reputation on cheating, sooner or later, you will be destroyed. We will catch you one way or another, and your reputation will be in the bin, as it is with people that we've seen in the past. So, you know, there's a clear message, I think, to current competitors.
Do you understand the frustration that people express, particularly after Daryl Impey's positive test, which was from an incident back in February? Roman Kreuziger is a result of the biological passport, and there's still a difficulty with the public at large understanding how can somebody be positive for drugs so far after the event. How come this has taken so long to come out? That's the perception of it. Do you think that the UCI need to do more in terms of educating on how the biological passport actually works, so that people don't think that somebody's been getting away with something for a while and then it comes out ages afterwards, and actually, although from those of us who are inside cycling, we understand how the biological passport works, for the wider public, it's a kind of what on earth is going on sort of scenario.
Yeah, I absolutely understand that. And I think we have got to work, first of all, with WADA, with the national anti-doping agencies and so on, because each of the cases that are ongoing have been generated within within different territories, as it were. So, you know, I think people sometimes have the idea that we at the UCI are in control of the timescales on all of those things, and in many cases, actually, we're not. But what I think it does demonstrate is, as I say, that we're not going to sweep anything under the carpet. If things come out in the run-up in the weeks before the Tour de France, that's frustrating for all of us and disappointing. I think it does demonstrate that, you know, we're not going to sit on these things. And you can imagine the outcry there would be if I'd somehow intervened and said, oh, don't release any of this information until after the Tour de France. The next thing I'd be reading on all over the media, Cookson delays anti-doping results to make sure the Tour de France is a success. So we won't do that. But it is frustrating, and I do think we've got to look at what we can do with WADA to accelerate those processes and make sure they're best possible, best practice, and so on. That's something that's an ongoing piece of work, and I hope to, in the months to follow, be able to work much more effectively on that process.
Brian, yesterday I was with Christophe Basson, and we talked a bit about the CIRC, your sort of version of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and he expressed concern that that might sap resources from present day sort of anti-doping, the fight on doping as it's happening now, and also just scepticism about, you know, how many people are actually coming forward and how far and how well that is advancing. You've suggested recently that people have come forward. Can you give any indication of numbers and also the kind of resources that it is taking up from the UCI? Is there someone working on it full time? And are they being taken off other anti-doping sort of responsibilities?
Okay, the Cycling Independent Reform Commission has got a budget of 3 million Swiss francs. That money has come from the reserves of the UCI, so it's not diminished the current budget of the Cycling Anti-Doping Foundation, which is the independent arm that we established to manage the current efforts against doping. So there is no reduction in the current effort. I think most of us would agree that it was necessary to have a commission like this. I never liked the phrase "truth and reconciliation," but you know, essentially, perhaps that's what it is. It's doing its work. It's entirely independent from the UCI. That was the conditions under which it was established. That was the way in which the three members of the commission agreed to take it on. I don't interfere with it. Nobody from UCI interferes with it on a day-to-day basis. I don't know who's going to speak to them, who they're going to speak in terms of individuals. All I do know is that the last time I spoke with the president of it a few weeks ago and the other two members, I was assured that they are making good progress, that they are travelling around, not just waiting for people to come knocking on their door, but they're going out meeting people. They're getting some very good evidence, some good commitments and contributions from some pretty key figures in that whole issue. So I think it's a process that we've got to go through. I think we need to let them get on with it. I was very anxious that it didn't become a circus, so that we didn't have, you know, banks of photographers camped outside their office waiting for Lance Armstrong or Johan Bruneel or whoever else to turn up. That's been achieved. They're going about their business with professionalism, with integrity, and I'm sure they're going to produce an interesting and worthwhile report with some good, solid recommendations for us for the future.
Brian, two issues arising from the recent story about Chris Froome's TUE therapeutic use exemption at the Tour of Romandy. One was the breach of medical confidentiality relating to Froome, and you know that the news that really shouldn't have come out about his TUE. But the second was the question over how that was approved and what the makeup is of the UCI's therapeutic use exemption committee. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us first of all what you're doing to find out how the information was leaked, and also clear up the confusion over the sure. committee and who's on it and how it works?
Okay. Well, first of all, how did that information leak? Well, that is a great concern to me. We are looking at whether that leak has come out of the UCI. First indications are that UCI was not the source of the leak, and that again causes me great concern. But you know, we will check. We will continue to check that, and certainly, I think people at UCI and the Cycling Anti-Doping Foundation are very, very aware of the sensitivity of that sort of thing. And you know, leaking that sort of information is not compatible with working in those organisations, if I can put it tactfully. So let's see what happens there. You know, but when there are. When there is information like this around, it's very important that those things are handled properly, confidentially. You know, there's always a conflict, if you like, between transparency and confidentiality in due process in these cases. So we'll do what we can at UCI and Cycling Anti-Doping Foundation will equally do the same, but there are others involved as well. What I think is frustrating is when stories like that emerge when, you know, to be honest, my view is that the journalists involved did not check the facts, first of all. If they'd come and talked to us before publishing that story about what had happened and how it had happened, we could have given them more facts. But, you know, to print a story under the headline, loosely translated from France, Froome doped by the UCI, now come on, you know, this is absolutely outrageous and it's not acceptable. And it's not true. So
you mentioned, though, about the radar lowering and making it hard for that kind of industrial type doping, as if I can put it that way. The suspicion is with the leak of this about Chris Froome is that there's a kind of there's a culture of taking medication within the peloton, and of course Chris Froome has been singled out because that was made public. We've discussed on the podcast the importance of anonymity when it comes to TUEs because people have a right to a medical privacy, but the situation remains that we had a rider who's the defending Tour de France champion in a key build-up race with an illness supposedly so serious he has to get quite a heavy-duty treatment for it, and then he goes and wins that race. There was also the images of him using an inhaler in the race, which, as we know, is perfectly legal. But again, when we're talking about the image of the sport, people watching on television, sponsors trying to come in, this causes cycling a problem, doesn't it? To take an extreme view, the sick man of Europe is winning one of the toughest bike races in May and then rolls up at the Tour de France, and there's no kind of transparency on which riders are on what medications. People are bound to ask questions, aren't they?
Yeah, I absolutely understand that, and it is a concern. But my feeling is, whatever my personal views about TUEs are, whether there even should be such a thing as a TUE, rather than if you have to take a substance that's on the proscribed list, then maybe you shouldn't be racing at all. Whatever my feelings might be about that, they are allowed under the WADA code. And the minute we tried to impose any action that was contrary to the WADA code, that would be the time that the lawyers would be down on us like a ton of bricks, and we would lose any sort of case like that. So we have to abide by the WADA code. I think we need to continue dialogue with WADA about how TUEs and how some of their processes impact on our sport, and it may be that we need to bring about some changes in that. Those are the things that I think we can start to look at. But I want to emphasise that both of the things that you've mentioned, and you said yourself, were entirely within the rules. The inhaler that Froome used was a substance that doesn't even require a TUE. That said, I don't think I've ever seen a rider using one mid-race. I'm not saying it hasn't ever happened, but I don't recall ever seeing one. And I think it wasn't a good image to see on the television screens, no doubt about that. And the TUE that Chris Froome received was issued in accordance with the guidelines. WADA confirmed that a couple of days later. But what we've done is look at those guidelines and we've said, well, there's a TUE committee needed, but what UCI had done in the past had been only to consult and involve the committee if there was a need for, if there was a particularly unusual case, if the circumstances were out of the ordinary, if the substance involved, if the illness, whatever, was something non-regular and uncommon. And in this case, it was an absolutely regular set of circumstances. There was no medical issues. The UCI doctor, Dr. Zazzoli, discussed with the team doctor, as he would for any other rider in the peloton, without any involvement from me or anybody else at UCI, and issued the TUE. And as I say, WADA confirmed that was acceptable in the circumstances. But what we've done since then is look at this and said, look, there is concern about this, that this should rest on the shoulders of one man. We do have a TUE committee. What we will now do is we won't do that any longer. We will refer every single TUE, however difficult that might be procedurally, however much that might cause a delay, because the reputational issue here for our sport is so important, we will involve the TUE committee in every TUE from now on, or rather a panel of the TUE committee. There are six people on it. Five of them are medical doctors with experience in sports medicine. One is a pharmacist and so on. So we will involve at least a panel of those people in every TUE decision from now on. And, you know, it's improvement of our processes. Again, I want to emphasise that nobody did anything wrong previously. The TUE was issued in accordance with the rules. The team applied the rules. The rider applied the rules. Our doctor applied the rules and so on. But we can do it better. We can do it more effectively. And we need to do that because what's really important here is the reputation of the sport. And that's our job. I think we can do a better job, and we are going to do a better job.
Lastly on this, sorry, just because the Le Journal de Dimanche story included the line about your son Oliver working for Team Sky, just want to address that. The perception from perhaps people who haven't worked in British cycling with a small c over the years and don't know the people will just automatically assume that there's some kind of bat phone between Oliver at Team Sky and you as president of the UCI. There is potential conflict of interest there. So what processes are in place to manage a potential conflict of interest, and what involvement, what kind of discussions do you and Oliver have, if any? And is it possible for anybody who has connections to call you up and try and get you to see things their way?
Well, first of all, as you know, because you wrote a piece yourself back in 2011, that Ollie's been working for Team Sky for 4 or 5 years now, and he's lived in Spain for 5 years and fluent Spanish, and has good organisational skills. So, you know, I didn't get him the job. I think if anyone knows any of those people involved with Team Sky, they don't take any passengers, and they certainly wouldn't employ somebody just because I was either British Cycling or UCI president. But I understand why people are concerned about that, and everything that we've done at the UCI since the new administration, as it were, took over is to establish and strengthen independent processes so that I don't get involved. You may recall during the election campaign, we talked very much about separating the president from any involvement in who gets tested, who doesn't get tested. And we've made the Cycling Anti-Doping Foundation entirely independent from the UCI. So there is nobody from the UCI Management Committee or the senior staff of the UCI, there is nobody on the board of the Cycling Anti-Doping Foundation. There's no conflict of interest there. They handle all of the anti-doping decisions about who gets tested, where, when, and how. Our legal anti-doping service as well is separate from UCI, the rest of the UCI's legal team. And we have external advice on how that operates as well. So absolutely, 100%, I do not get involved in any potential involvement in who gets tested in any of those anti-doping processes at all. We have more than Chinese walls. We have clear procedures that that prevent that happening, and that's absolutely important to the integrity of the sport. We have there will often be conflicts of interest arising in any activity in any business and so on. What's important is that you deal with them appropriately, that you have processes in place to declare those conflicts of interest, and the fact that my son works for Team Sky was declared during my time at British Cycling and is now, as a matter of record, and has been all along, on the UCI's conflict of interest register. So I don't get involved in any decision that involves anything to do with my son. And, I hope my son has integrity and ethics himself as well, so I don't get to know what goes on inside of Team Sky. And it will be a problem for both of us if we got involved in those kind of indiscreet discussions. We can't. And all I can say is that I'll try and do my job in the way that I did my job as British Cycling President, with integrity, honesty, and transparency. And I hope people will respect that.
Final question then, Brian. Cameras on bikes, that's something we've seen a bit of footage from this year. I think it's something you're pushing a little bit for, and it's going to happen at the Tour as well. You've been encouraged by what you've seen, and what are your plans to continue that sort of evolution in broadcasting cycling?
Yeah, absolutely. And the experiments that we've agreed so far have been very, very successful. I think the technology is developing all of the time. It's a bit difficult at the moment to get live pictures because of the reception issues and the bandwidth issues and so on, transmission and so on. But I think the point is, look, let's look at all these new forms of technology. If you look at the way cycling is covered, road racing is covered on the television, it's not changed for 20, 25 years. So you look at other sports, there's technology, much more technology in play. So we have to work hard to compete with that. We have to move forward. We have to look at what technology is available and embrace it, not reject it. And so, I think let's try and do that. I know ASO have got plans to try and develop the technology. We want to work with them. We want to help people so that you can get a better image of our sport in the media.
Podcast daily during the Tour de France. This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.